Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. One 100 years ago, science and religion, evolution and Christianity, Darrow and Bryan, North and South, clashed in Ray County, Tennessee. The trial of the century was a spectacle, designed to be a spectacle, and has captured America's attention and imagination ever since. The legal case itself really decided none of those conflicts or questions, and it barely even resolved the underlying case involving John Scopes. We are repeating the fight down to this day. Joining me to explore this fascinating history and the implications for us here in the modern world is Edward J. Larson, historian and legal scholar. He has a PhD in the history of science, which sounds like a really cool major, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, go Badgers, and a law degree from Harvard. He currently holds the Hugh and Hazel Darling Chair in Law and is University Professor of History at Pepperdine University. Before becoming a professor, Larson practiced law in Seattle and served as counsel for the U.S. House of Representatives. Larson has written a number of books on American history, including the reason we brought him on today, Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. And Summer for the Gods won the 1998 Pulitzer Prize for History, which I think makes Professor Larson our first Pulitzer winner on this podcast, though I may have to go back and check that. Professor Larson, welcome to One Nation Indivisible. Before we dive into the trial, I want to talk just a little bit about your career, because it's fascinating to me. You've won a Pulitzer. Congrats. That's amazing. I'm jealous. And as far as I've been able to tell, you're the only person to have been a fellow at the Discovery Institute, which is known for its kind of anti-evolution, intelligent design. I'll say rabble-rousing. And you're also a winner of the National Center for Science Education Friend of Darwin Award. So you've got this really kind of fascinating history. You've got a history of science PhD from the University of Madison, which we were talking about is just down the street from where I'm recording. How did you kind of get to where you are?
Well, I am both a lawyer and a historian of science. And my connection with the Discovery Institute came before they did anything to do with intelligent design. They actually started as, I was a lawyer in Seattle, and they started as an organization involved with regional issues, Cascadia, they called it, trying to integrate British Columbia and Seattle with rail lines and change politics. A former Secretary of State of the state of Washington had founded it, and people like Ruckelshaus, William Ruckelshaus was on the board, Joel Pritchard, who was a congressman, and I was a lawyer in Seattle. I was very interested in those community building and inner cross-border issues. But I'd left the organization before they got involved with intelligent design.
It's interesting. So it's almost like a sort of an NRA situation where it kind of got morphed or taken over later on.
Yeah, I don't know how much. I really wasn't privy to it, so I don't know if it was taken over. The idea was, as I understood it, and I was involved just when it was beginning. I was still involved just when it was beginning. They wanted to do more things, and they'd already added a couple more things. They were dealing with neighborhoods, development in Seattle, the idea of neighborhood sort of decentralizing power within the city and the neighborhoods. They were also dealing with cross-border Cascadia ones, which were issues I was dealing with. They had some other issues. And so they were approached by, I think of his name, from Whitworth College to work on the intelligent design issue. And so they sort of added that as an additional activity. But you're probably right. Over time, long after I left, maybe the tail wagged the dog, it probably became their more visible area.
Yeah, the tail wagged the dog. I mean, controversy, you know, gets you attention. So as we'll talk about in a moment. And so, well, let's move to the trial, because July 10th marks the 100th anniversary of the start of the Scopes trial, which was, you know, the trial of the century. So can you, before we dive into the nitty gritty, can you help set the stage? The year's 1925. World War I has ended 7 years ago. The Depression is around the corner. So these are the roaring 20s. Can you tell us what the country is like in the general atmosphere to set the stage for this dramatic show trial?
Sure. And I do, great question, because I do think that stage setting is important. And I love the way that you started with the World War I, because the Roaring Twenties, as you call them, they weren't called that yet. That's a name that was attached to them later. During the time, they were called the Jazz Age. At least Fitzgerald called them that. And of course, his books, F. Scott Fitzgerald's books, sort of capture the era. Whether true or not, the Americans at that time perceived the country was becoming more secular. Right in the name, the Jazz Age or Roaring Twenties. Certainly William Jennings Bryan, who was an old-style politician, populist politician from the 1890s, deemed it so or said as much at the stump. His authority for the becoming more secular is a little bit dicey. What he used on evidence was there wasn't much in public opinion polling back then, but he went back to a very crude public opinion poll from the 1916s, done by James Lerba at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania. And it allegedly found that half of the social and natural science scientists responding to his surveys acknowledged that disbelief in immortality and a personal God. And among college students, and this was even a cruder study, he claimed on the stump repeatedly, and he said this time and time again. Remember, he was a professional stump speaker. After he lost his three campaigns for president, he published a newspaper out of his home state of Nebraska with his brother and went around speaking. 200 paid public speaker speeches a year on average.
Wow.
That was his income, plus the associated books and pamphlets that he published. And he repeatedly claimed, in arguing America was becoming more secular, and this only started after World War I, during the so-called Roaring Twenties, that he had this poll, which was really dicey, that among students in college, belief in immortality, that is, life after death, rose, disbelief in it, that is, not believing it, rose from 15% among first-year students to 30% among juniors, and then he claimed that it was 40% among graduates. But if you look at the actual study, it does show that for first-year students and second and juniors, but it shows the number dropping for seniors, and it doesn't include graduates. It shows his imaginative, self-justifying use of facts, which is typical of, well, I hate to say it, but it's typical of populists, and Brian was a populist. He also would talk about the war. Now, the World War I was the most, the deadliest war, the most disrupting war of history up to that point. It truly was the first world war. Between 15 and 25 million people died during the conflict, which by the 20s seemed to be a meaningless conflict, sort of only made the world worse, sort of like the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, the bombing of Libya does now to us. Exaggerating even those numbers when Brian in his speeches and in his articles would say that 30 million people died. And he attributed it, using again some articles and statements, he attributed it to a belief in a survival of the fittest mentality as driving the German war effort. And so, as he said, as he declared in 1921 in his speech, to destroy the faith of Christians and lay the foundations for the bloodiest war of history would seem enough to condemn Darwinism. Wow. Then you add to that the Spanish flu, which was the worst global pandemic in world history. 50 million people died. A fifth of the population was infected. 750,000 Americans died. And then the war unleashed the largest refugee crisis in world history, with 20 million people, mainly from Eastern Europe or Asia Minor, driven from their homelands with the fall of multi-ethnic empires like the Ottoman Empire or the Russian Empire or the Austro-Hungary Empire, with these ethnic states that practiced ethnic cleansing. And many of those immigrants came to the United States, which responded in 1924 with the Immigration Act, which was the first national limitation on immigration imposed by law, where it said that for no country may spend more than new visas for more than 2% of the total number of American citizens from that country in 1890. So trying to push America back to its immigration profile of the of an earlier era. Brian totally supported that move. And this was all part of the nation's return to normalcy. Remember, Warren G. Harding and his Republican Party had won the election in 1920 as president, campaigning under a pledge to put America first. That was the campaign program that was on their campaign buttons. And for them, America first meant limiting immigration, imposing tariffs, and establishing order, domestic political order. And, you know, you not only have
Sounds
the war,
familiar
but you also have, you know, the First World War brought the Bolsheviks to power in Russia, leading to the Red Scare and fostering labor unrest and violent strikes and even more violent strike breaking and the efforts to suppress the rise of communism in America. And then you top on top of that, you have the Great Migration of black people from the American South, attracted to the North with promises of higher wages and jobs in manufacturing business and fleeing the racial violence of the South. And this migration disrupted both the North and the South, with the South losing a lot of its agricultural workers and bringing the so-called jazz age to northern cities. What'd you get in a result? Prohibition, new laws against drug use, the outlawing of many drugs, new laws or new enforcement of laws against interracial marriage, and measures to reestablish social norms such as residential segregation through racial housing covenants, which too were backed by Bryan. Bryan was a big supporter of Jim Crow laws, for example, in the American South, as part of his populist agenda. Wow. And this, through this app, one throughout thing, and this is so important for understanding the Tennessee law against the teaching of evolution in public schools. Education restriction were a fundamental part of the American First agenda. During the war years, states had passed laws to prohibit the teaching, to promote the teaching of patriotism, to bar instruction in German, or bar the teaching about communism or socialism, to mandate flag salutes for the first time, and classroom prayer, spreading classroom prayer. Those are all dating from this period. Schools and colleges across America, including Columbia University, dismissed teachers for opposing the war or encouraging pacifism. Some of this had been done locally before, it's true, but with the rise of state compulsory attendance laws, which hadn't really existed before, but now were pushed to assimilate immigrants, an increasing number of states made it official policy. Education restrictions expanded in the early 1920s with state laws requiring Bible reading in school, forbidding the employment of teachers who were deemed radicals or pacifist or communist or socializing, mandating the teaching of capitalism, and in one case, prohibiting teaching, quote, that ours is an inferior form of government. So the anti-evolution crusade fit, that is, a crusade to ban the teaching of evolution in public schools, fit right into what was happening. It wasn't an isolated, oh, religious groups are turning against this. Now, you already had this broader way, and that's why the ACLU was involved. The ACLU back then was not an anti-religious organization or wasn't even perceived of it. It had been founded by Quakers during World War I to defend pacifists and conscientious objectors during the war. They had become very involved in free speech. They had been very involved in fighting like UCLA requiring all male students to be in ROTC, limiting of academic freedom, of mandating certain coursework or banning the teaching of German. They were involved with those. And so they naturally went to oppose Bryan's crusade against teaching evolution in public schools, not because it was religiously motivated, but because they viewed it as a restriction on free speech and academic freedom.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
So this is a time of intense change after a collective human trauma, years of collective trauma, and the sort of the reigning political feeling or vibe, as we might say now, is to recover, to get back to the way things were, to put America first, to get back to that time when things were simpler and better. And the clash that results from this law that Tennessee passed that becomes the Scopes trial, this was not organic. The case that we know, it was an orchestrated case, and it was not even orchestrated in an adversarial way. It was kind of orchestrated in this collaborative fashion that, when I was reading the book, this was something I did not know. That's really almost more about publicity and tourism than it is about the legal fight. Can you tell us how this case was really kind of built from the ground up?
Well, to say, yes, I agree with you, but most really signal landmark cases were orchestrated. I mean, Dred Scott was an orchestrated case. He'd already been back to Missouri, and basically he was found by the abolitionists.
Plessy versus Ferguson.
Plessy versus Ferguson was an orchestrated case. You're right. So was Buck versus Bell, the upholding of eugenic segregation, totally orchestrated case. So was the school desegregation cases. So was Roe versus Wade. These were orchestrated cases. In a way, Dobbs was an orchestrated case.
Yeah.
They wrote a statute that would be a test. So being an orchestrated case, here, that orchestration was, yes, the ACLU wanted to challenge the Tennessee law as un-American. I guess that's safer to say than unconstitutional. Yeah. They wanted to push what was then understood as constitutional and unconstitutional. Remember, when the case was brought, the First Amendment, at least the free speech, there was no such thing as academic freedom in the Constitution, and free speech had not yet been applied to the states, and this was a state law. And they wanted, Getlow hadn't been decided, they wanted to move this to so that the First Amendment applied through the 14th Amendment, the free speech clause applied to the states. So yes, that was orchestrated. Now, on the other end, and that's what you were sort of stressing, when the ACLU put out its advertisement, its notice that it would defend any, as soon as the law was passed, their advertisement, just as they would defend people opposing mandatory flag salutes or school prayer or teaching capitalism, they would defend any Tennessee school teacher willing to challenge this law in court, which they meant, what they expected was a what's known as a declaratory judgment action. They'd file suit on behalf of the teacher to declare this law unconstitutional, and so it'd be a declaratory judgment action. That was their intent. Now, what happened was most of the school districts in the state, the big city ones, didn't want the embarrassment. They viewed the law as embarrassing. And so you could see articles, because passage of this law was huge. Bryan had been crusading for such a law. He had been traveling around the country, including there in Wisconsin, where you live. There were bills before the state legislature there. He'd spoken at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in support of all this in the early 1920s. He'd gotten close in Kentucky, one vote short in Kentucky. This was a national crusade. Tennessee just had, and lesser restrictions had been passed in Florida, Oklahoma, a number of other states, and many school districts. Columbus, Ohio, for example, had banned the teaching of human evolution. His daughter lived there, so he spent a lot of time in Columbus. The Tennessee became the first state that really went in whole hog and actually passed a ban. So the ACLU had been dogging this, had been following this crusade around the country. And then when Tennessee passed it, they offered. Now, this was front page news, the passage of the statute, front page news across the country. And so Chattanooga, Nashville, the school superintendents in these schools all said, we're not bringing the case here. We don't.
Keep it out of our backyard. We don't want any part of it.
Not here. Yeah. But Dayton, Tennessee was a shrinking town in the hills of East Tennessee, a new town, not particularly religious in any way, not racially mixed. It was a white town. It had been, you know, the railroads had come in and it basically came into existence in the 1880s. It had great hopes. It built a big courthouse. It really was promoted. They built some smelters there. And then it sort of collapsed. The iron mills, the smelters closed, and it was on the downstacle, and still had about 1,800 people in it. And they decided, this will be interesting. Remember, they were the law. Bryan was a Democrat, passed by Democrats, controlled the state, conservative Southern Democrats. They controlled the state legislature. Dayton is in Republican East Tennessee. Tennessee historically was split. The East didn't want to, the mountains areas where there were not many enslaved people didn't want to succeed, didn't want to leave the Union during the Civil War. That's why it's called the Volunteer State. And so they thought this would be an interesting thing. They called it a summer Chautauqua. Or we can test this law. Right near, I know this is local Tennessee stuff, but Chautauquas were big back then because you didn't have TV yet. And Chautauqua was named for the one that's still around in New York. But there was a big Chautauqua, still is, in Mount Eagle, right near Dayton, up in the mountains. It's cooler. And people still go there and hear lectures during the summer. People like Brian would speak in these things. And they figure, well, we stage this thing for the summer, and people will come in, probably people over from Mount Eagle. We'll get attention to our town. And we'll bring in leaders from both sides, and they'll sort of discuss the merits of this statute. They even sent a letter inviting H.G. Wells, who was then the best-selling author in the world, who was a known evolutionist in England, to come over and argue, because they wanted big names. They didn't think of Brian and Darrow.
Yeah.
And so, and the judge, when it was, he was the circuit judge, he agreed, okay, they normally wouldn't have had a session there. We'll have a session for the summer, and we'll hold it in the baseball field, because that'll be big enough for the big crowds that come to Chautauquas. And so that's the way they were thinking of it. And they, Scopes, John Scopes, wasn't even a biology teacher. He never taught evolution, and everybody knew that. But he was young. He was, he didn't like the law. As did the person who proposed this idea, a guy named Rapelier was his last name. He was the young manager of the closed mines. He didn't like the law. He'd been writing letters opposing it. The town was sort of split. Some people sort of liked it. It wasn't a big issue. And so they asked the school chairman of the school board, Robinson, and the superintendent of schools, White, brought him down to the drugstore and asked him, you know, will you stand as a defendant? Because they thought, they didn't think in the way of declaratory judgment action. They thought, well, be a criminal case. We'll indict Scopes. They promised his job back. He was never jailed. There was no threat of jail. The fine, it was listed as a gross misdemeanor under statute, which mean the fine would be between $100 and $500 if convicted. Again, he was promised his job back. John Scopes was popular. He was the football coach. He was first year teaching. He was brought down to be the football coach at the local high school. And so they thought it'd be attract tourists, attract reporters, attract attention to their town, and perhaps jobs and a future, and growth. And they didn't think they'd be at the center of the storm. They thought naively that people would view them as just staging the event and not as a hostile community that had indicted one of their own school teachers. They thought they would be a host, and therefore they wouldn't look bad. They would attract attention and test the wisdom of this statute.
And they do get caricatured later on. You know, I had the privilege of speaking at the Chautauqua, the one in New York still, on the one-year anniversary or commemoration of the attack on Salman Rushdie. And it is an amazing experience. You're in this huge outdoor venue. Hundreds of people show up to hear you speak about, you know, what can be a controversial subject, and you can really put yourself, you can see how they're, you know, I picture these three guys standing over, you know, in the drugstore, standing over like at the soda fountain or something, going back and forth over this, trying to decide. And like, you can see the appeal in a way. Now you mentioned the judge in the trial, and this really stuck out to me because every time I feel like he was mentioned, he seemed to me like anything but impartial. You know, he offers a public benediction before one of the events, says that he wants God in every one of his official acts. He arrives the day of the trial carrying a statute book and a Bible, which seems like a pretty clear unification of church and state. I believe he reads from the book of Genesis when he's asking the grand jury to indict Scopes. And then every day the courtroom opens with a prayer every day of the trial. So can you tell us a little bit more about the judge and whether there was a possibility of a fair trial here?
Well, John Ralston was a judge, and he was not from Dayton. I think was Winchester. He was from a nearby town, and he was the judge for the circuit, and he was up for re-election that year. And that played a factor in it. He was a Methodist, so he wasn't a Bible thumper. He wasn't a fundamentalist. The Methodist would be the closest things to a liberal in Tennessee, East Tennessee at that time. That would basically, Methodist would be sort of the equivalent to being a Unitarian today. Back then, a Methodist would sort of fill that role. He was honestly curious about the dispute. He certainly wasn't there's no indication he was a creationist or a young earth creationist. He believed in he was religious. He went to church. I think he thought he was trying to stage a fair trial. That's why he let Brian go on the stand rational judge would have prohibited that activity. He knew it was a show trial. He rescheduled it so it'd be in the summer when he normally wouldn't go to Dayton and Swelder in that weather. He allowed cameras in the courtroom. It was all filmed. He allowed, it was first broadcast trial. He allowed microphones in the trial, in the courtroom, and everybody was speaking into the microphones. And he liked the publicity, but he was very open to reporters. He talked to reporters all the time, in and out. That got him in trouble a few times when he sort of spilled ahead of time what he was going to do. So I thought he was sincere in that. Yeah, he lived in a world where religion was true. Now, his religion wasn't necessarily, it certainly wasn't the young earth creationism of today. It certainly wasn't a fundamentalism, but it was a religion. He just viewed religion as the world he lived in. And that came out. But I think the ACLU, after they went out, left and would comment on it, even the leaders of the defense, even Darrow sort of grudgingly said he was trying to be fair, the best he could be fair in his own thinking. But certainly he did think, I don't think he was a biblical literalist. He thought the Bible was an authoritative book. And as for prayer, remember, yes, he brought in, there were pretty conservative preachers giving the opening prayer at the beginning. And they were militantly for the statute and for Brian and against the ACLU. But when the issue was raised by Darrow and the defense,
they sort of challenged the practice of giving prayers. Yeah.
He changed the pool and he said, I'll no longer make it. Everybody who's religious here for this, and that included a Jewish rabbi, that included Unitarians who'd come down to be on the side of, and a leading theologian from University of Chicago who was a modernist. So modernists, Protestants, Jewish rabbis, Unitarians were all there. He put them all in a pool and they said, you pick it. And some of them got to speak. Unitarians got to give the prayer sometime and a Jewish rabbi. So in that sense, I think within his ability, he was trying to be as fair as possible. Now, this sort of show, this sort of worldview that these Darrow from Chicago and the other New York attorneys and the professors from University of Chicago, professors from all over, but real theological professors from University of Chicago, which was a modernist you know, seminary, that was a new world to him. And he was actually interested in it. And so I think he did as much as somebody, you know, he came up with the idea of making Darrow a colonel as well, a temporary colonel, in the, so that he could have the title of colonel, because Brian had it, because sure. Brian had the status of a colonel, mm-hmm, and they always called him colonel. They used military terms. So I think he did as good as fair a job as he could.
Well, let's explore some of those major themes, because you mentioned a few of them in the answer, and you do a wonderful job in the book itself of kind of highlighting and teasing out those major themes that run through the books. You mentioned modernism versus fundamentalism being one, obviously science versus religion. You talked a little bit about the beginning when you were talking about the ACLU, that the idea of individual rights mm-hmm. versus majority rule. And then, you know, even with the titles right there, you have North, you know, kind of the world really versus South, the former Confederacy. It was a really great way to organize the book, but what are those themes still ring true for you right now, even today?
Well, what Dayton hadn't expected was they thought that this would be just, they were honestly bringing a debate, fostering a debate mm-hmm. over an idea of whether you should ban the teaching of evolution. So they thought, yeah, they knew that would raise issues of individual rights versus majority rule. Brian, you know, was an old-fashioned Democrat, an old-fashioned progressive. And to him, what America stood for was majority rule. People are always right. Sort of that old Jefferson saw that, you know, that whatever they say, the people are right. And therefore, you want initiative and referendum. You want a single house legislature, which he backed. You want eventually came around to females voting as well. But you just want, you know, democracy. And whatever the people decide is right. And Brian would say that. That is one view of the American tradition. Another view is individual rights. And that goes back in American tradition as well. And ACLU and Clarence Darrow stood for individual rights. Clarence Darrow was never believed in government. He was, if anything, he would be a libertarian of sorts. He distrusted government. Government had oppressed labor, and he defended labor leaders. They had imposed the Palmer raids and the various different activities to suppress civil liberties during World War I, and he had opposed those. And so he was very much with the ACLU in supporting individual rights. Now, individual rights automatically run against majority rule, because individual rights are defending the government. Now, if you have a functioning democracy, it's the majority that's imposing limits on the minority. If you have a monarchy, it's the king. Sure, that's easy, because in revolutionary era, you could be for individual rights and for majority rule, because you were fighting with the king and, you know, a British parliament was imposing. But at this time, there is no reason to believe that the anti-evolution law, or the restrictions on teaching German, or the requirement to have school prayer, or the requirement to have flag salutes, they probably did have majority support. And so to fight them for individual rights. So that was articulated, and they knew in Dayton, they were smart enough to know that was a real issue. Well, that was part of what they wanted spoken about. And when they just lucked out to get Brian to volunteer to come in and join the prosecution, they didn't expect that. And then when Brian came in, Clarence Darrow, who was equally famous, the most famous trial lawyer in America at the time, and not only a champion of individual rights, also a champion of anti-clericalism. Now, that they weren't expecting. But to get Darrow, who... Both Brian and Darrow at the time were two of the most popular public speakers. They both could fill Carnegie Hall if they were
celebrities.
Built. They both did fill Carnegie Hall or any other hall in America. And they were both public speakers. Darrow was also a trial lawyer, but he was also a public speaker. He would be sort of like the, on religion, he'd be sort of like the Richard Dawkins of his day, but he was so much more than Richard Dawkins, in the sense that he was also a lawyer and he was also, more of a public speaker than Dawkins, but he also wrote like Dawkins did. Not quite as good as Dawkins, but he wrote well. So that they suspected. They might have suspected the science versus religion one. But what they would not have expected was the rural, urban, and the north-south aspect. East Tennessee didn't view itself as particularly south. But what you, what the, once the media got involved, once the media proclaimed, remember, Roaring Twenties was an era of celebrity journalism and yellow journalism. You had the Hearst chain throughout America, newspapers. Every major city had a Hearst newspaper. Everyone had a Pulitzer paper. You had the Bennett chain. You had these big chain newspapers. You had multiple newspapers in every town, and they all practiced celebrity journalism. It was the age of Mary Pickford and Charles Chaplin and Babe Ruth. And so Brian and Darrow were sort of celebrities as well as everything else. So when the newspapers clamped onto this, when they made it a media event, when they proclaimed it the trial of the century before it even began, when they all sent reporters, hundreds of reporters, where they laid thousands of miles of telegraph line into Dayton to sort of teletape out every word being spoken so that you would have front page transcripts in virtually every newspaper, major newspaper in the country the next day, when the radio lines were put in, when they plowed down a cornfield so that airplanes could land, first time ever, so they could, the film, because it was film, the film of the trial could be flown out that day and shown at night in movie halls in New York, in Cleveland, in other towns, and while people, because, you know, there's silent movie, were read the script and people were watching this with the day. Well, what's going to sell? Well, down goes H.L. Mencken, one of the most popular journalists of the day, whose columns in the Baltimore Sun were syndicated throughout America. And he decides, he's always been sort of he's a modernist and a secularist. Sure. And he knows just the hot lines to pull. And that this is North versus South, that this is a lynching. It wasn't a lynching. The guy wasn't even threatened losing his job. Brian promised to pay the fine if Scopes was convicted. But this is a lynching. Remember, lynchings were big back then. Lynchings of black people in the South. This was a lynching of a school teacher by his hometown. So it is that, and that plays into Southern. So this is North versus South. This is. You know, America had been a rural country, was now majority urban. This was rural versus urban. You could play new themes, and this trial fit into every one of those stereotypes if you cast it that way. But the way you cast it, the way you make it a big story, and this is what Mencken and many others, not everybody, not Joseph Wood Krutch, who was probably as big as Mencken at the time, who is sympathetic to Dayton. You cast it as this small town is attacking one of its own. It's like the Salem witchcraft trials.
Yeah.
We're taking Scopes. Remember, this was a friendly prosecution, as you point out. This town is turning on one of its own because he's teaching modern science. Yeah. And it is lynching him. So you make it a crime where Scopes is the victim and the people of the town are the villain. And that plays in Baltimore, that plays in New York, that plays in LA. But of course, it doesn't play in Georgia. It doesn't play in Mississippi. It doesn't play in Tennessee. And so but it attracts attention there. And those areas of the country and their newspapers become very, very defensive. The Vanderbilt Agrarians, which was a writing movement out of Vanderbilt in Tennessee, those people, and they're very popular writers, they align trying to defend Dayton, that this is not what's happening.
Yeah.
And Joshua Crutch did as well, and Crutch. And so you end up creating a spectacle. You end up creating division. You end up creating polarization. And what does that do? Sell newspapers.
Well, and that sensationalizing of it is, to me, it's a particularly fascinating aspect of it because, right, I've been doing church-state separation for almost 20 years now and, you know, handling complaints that come in of, you know, a kid in a school in Georgia, for instance, where their teacher's praying with them before they go down to lunch, say. That's happened a number of times. And when the media calls to talk about one of those cases, they have a template of a narrative that they want to fill. And it is often the template that you have identified in this case. You know, it's one lone person standing up in a backwater. It's a very common way that it is framed even down today. And so let's talk about the climax of the show trial, because this is Darrow calls Brian, the opposing counsel, the opposing lawyer, as a witness and cross-examines him. And there are some exchanges that are, you know, they kind of echo down through history. Darrow says, you insult every man of science and learning in the world because he doesn't believe in your fool religion. You know, Brian says, I want the Christian world to know that any atheist, agnostic, unbeliever can question me anytime as to my belief in God, and I'll answer him. You know, other lawyers are objecting. The judge allows it. How does this even happen? And it seems to me that this is the thing that, like, yes, it was the trial of the century, and yes, it was sensational, but this is the thing that really just kind of captures our attention and imagination forever.
Yeah, and adding to your first quote about full religion, it goes on to say that Darrow said, who doesn't believe in your full religion, that no reasonable Christian believes either. I mean, you know, he wasn't trying to down Christianity as a full religion. He said, your particular take on it, which no reasonable Christian believes. It came about because originally Brian had said, when Brian joined the case, he said, this will be a battle royal between, you know, evolution and he had said he was joining in, he was going to bring in experts, he was going to make his case for the reasonableness of this law. Of and Brian's critique of evolution was twofold. He was a populist. First, he says public schools should teach what the taxpayers want, what the voters want. And if they don't want evolution, they shouldn't have evolution. And second, he said, and evolution is teaching evolution and belief in evolution, he would argue, is the cause of all the woes of society. And he would list them all. loss of religion, but also labor exploitation. Mistreatment of people. Also the World War. I mean, he was tying up everything in this sort of scientific materialism, in the idea of well, you'd call it social Darwinism, survival of the fittest thinking, the law of hate, as he'd call it. A line he loved to do, because he was good at turning phrases, a line he loved to use is, you teach children that they descend from apes and they'll act like monkeys. Mm-hmm. So he thought he could make those twin points. And the ACLU's team came prepared the other way. And they had top scientists and theologians from, you know, Johns Hopkins University and Princeton and Vanderbilt and University of Chicago and all over. They had a defense team that they had a advisory team that included the president of where you live, University of Wisconsin, but also the president of Harvard, the president of Stanford, and the president of the University of Michigan, and the president of Columbia, which is funny because he was the guy who threw out all the during World War II, all the socialists and pacifists from his faculty. But he viewed this differently. So the trouble was Brian couldn't find anybody. Brian couldn't find anybody to argue on his side. And so they shifted strategy after the ACLU had brought down their team and just said, we're going to object to any expert witnesses at all. We're going to object to debating the merits of the idea. We're going to only argue that the law says what the law says, that it's illegal for a public school teacher in Tennessee to teach the theory that humans evolved from a lower order of animal and therefore contradicts the divine scriptures. That's what the law says. Pretty close. And the and so all they did was bring in a couple hours of testimony from students who were coached by Scopes to say that he taught evolution, even though he really hadn't. And they brought in the school textbook, which he didn't teach from, but includes the theory of evolution. And that was their whole case. And then when the defense tried to bring in its expert witnesses, they ruled that they're irrelevant because the only issue is whether Scopes taught evolution. This court, if you want to challenge the constitutionality of the law or the wisdom of the law, appeal. Take it to the Tennessee Supreme Court. Let them decide. This court only decides if he did. And the judge went along with that. And therefore, the expert witnesses couldn't testify. So then the weekend comes. And all that's left, they thought, were the closing arguments and, as Mencken famously said, the execution of the indicted Scope.
And a lot of people split town too, right?
Including H.L. Mencken, because he wasn't let in on what Darrow had come up with. Darrow was one of the cleverest. I defer to you. You may be a better one, but he was arguably the cleverest lawyer in American history. He developed so many of the techniques that people use today, like jury selection and closing argument. He decides, what I'm going to do is, since I can't bring in my other witnesses, the statute says you can't teach the theory that humans evolved or descended from a lower order of animals in contradiction of the Bible. Well, I tried to bring in Bible experts. They got excluded. I tried to bring in scientific experts. And every scientist, by the way, they're very smart. They did a good job of picking their witnesses. Every single one of the scientists they brought in was a practicing Christian who taught Sunday school and was involved in the church. They were, you know, they weren't young earth creationists, but they were all religious and they were all Christians. And so, and they would have testified to that fact. So he comes up with the idea of calling Brian. Now, Brian, of course, could refuse, but he decided this way back when a week earlier, when the prosecution had made clear that they were going to object to expert witnesses. So he'd come up with the idea, well, if I can't get anybody else, I will invite Brian, who's very confident in himself and very full of himself. And remember, Brian not only gave 200 lectures on average a year, paid lectures, he had a weekly column on Brian and the Bible. And like Jimmy Carter did, he taught a Sunday school. He by then had retired. Brian never retired. Brian had moved to Florida, Coral Gables, Florida, and he taught a weekly Sunday school. And he had a weekly Bible column. And those published in, you know, hundreds of papers around the country. And so he said, I'll try to call Brian to the stand as an expert witness on the Bible to talk about how, you know, to connect up how the statute says, do not teach that humans descended from a lower foreign animal in contradiction to the Bible. Now, Darrow is the master questioner, but he had goaded during the whole prior week of the trial. He and the other defense lawyers, Arthur Garfield Hayes, Dudley Malone, had sort of, and both at the trial and also in their private comments, had been criticizing Brian's intelligence. And also his not speaking at trial much. Now, Brian mm-hmm. didn't speak at trial. He basically was an observer. And what he'd do is he'd be at the prosecution seat. But Brian was never quick. He wasn't like Darrow. He wasn't quick. What he was good was a stump speaker. If he had a stump speech, he was really good. But he was not quick in that way with going back and forth and stuff like that.
So he's an ideal witness for Darrow to call.
So yeah. So he would only speak in the evening to the press. And so they'd say, oh, Brian doesn't have the courage to say anything in court. Yeah. I mean, Brian hadn't tried. He was a lawyer, but he hadn't tried a case since before he became a member of Congress in the 1890s. So he had no experience in the courtroom for 30 years. And so they'd sort of goaded him and printed him and goaded him and goaded him. And then on the last day, after they thought was only closing arguments left, and the judge, who was up for re-election, and the courtroom basically could only hold the reporters and only had so many seats, he had moved the trial outside so that everybody could hear the closing arguments, because he knew everybody, a couple thousand people, poured onto the courthouse lawn. There was a bandstand out there, a crude bandstand that had been built up because this was a show trial. There were ox roasts. There were carnival games going on mm-hmm. outside. People had poured in. They couldn't fit in the courtroom, so there were remote areas with speakers so they could listen in places. And so he'd moved the trial outside because he thought there were only going to be closing arguments. Brian and Darrow, two of the greatest speakers in America, giving their summations and closing arguments. Everybody should hear it, especially if I'm up for re-election. So he moved the courtroom out there. And instead, Hayes, not Darrow, because you didn't want to make it that telegraphic, obvious, called, said, we have one expert. There's one other expert we'd like to call. Now, I know you said you can't take any experts, but here's an expert that not even the prosecution will object to. On issues of the Bible and the source of the law. Remember, Brian had been the source of these laws. He had gone to Nashville, Tennessee, and given a talk that led to the introduction of statutes. He had been speaking to joint sessions of the state legislature in West Virginia, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, arguing Kentucky, and North Carolina, arguing for these laws. He was the source of the law. It was his crusade. Now, and he had spoken in Nashville that led to the enactment of the law. So he was, in all sense, a relevant witness. But of course, he didn't have to go up. He was one of the prosecution lawyers, even though he hadn't said much in court. And they thought he was going to give the closing. He had prepared a masterful closing argument. You know, it's probably, experts in speech say it's second only to his Cross of Gold speech at the Democratic National Convention in 1896, that it's partly his best speech. It's a magnificent speech on the rights on for paper. Majorities to control education and the critique of evolution. Masterful in the sense it's very persuasive. Mm-hmm. And he was going to give that. So they call him, and the thought is he has so much ego and he's so confident in himself that he'll accept. Now, Brian Darrow had prepared. He had privately prepared. He hadn't even told Mencken about it. He had one of his own experts who understood Brian serve as a dummy witness, and he had prepared his questions. He had used mock setups before, so he knew what he was doing. It was not spontaneous. And Brian agrees. Brian says he wants to get in his own words, and he thinks the questions are going to be presumably about the wisdom of the statute and evolution, and he has stump speech answers that he's memorized for these questions. And so he agrees. Now, the lead prosecutor, who was really a very able prosecutor, state's attorney, who also wasn't from Dayton, Normally, this would be handled by the local city solicitors because it was just a misdemeanor, equivalent to like having a still back then during Prohibition. But they'd sent over the state's, a very able state's attorney. He later became a U.S. senator, served two terms as a U.S. senator. Very able, and he was handling the case. Well, he objected immediately. He says, you can't call Brian to the stand, but Brian insisted on going.
And I mean, legally, like procedurally, from a legal standpoint, this is crazy. It's like,
but remember, it's also crazy to have the whole, back then, yeah, it's all being filmed. There are, yeah, there are teletypes in the courtroom clicking out every word.
It goes
word.
To the show trial
there
aspect
is
of it. Like,
microphones in the courtroom. no, you know, it's all the press in there. It's not a normal trial from the beginning. It was not a normal trial. And yeah, the judge says, well, this is, Brian can defend himself. This ought to be interesting. And it's outside with 2,000 people spread out there and going through the aisles, you know, kids were selling soda and selling peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I mean, it was finally the summer Chautauqua that they yeah ever thought about. And so Brian says, yes, I'll go on the stand. I'll defend him. And what Darrow does is Darrow is set. He knows what he's doing. Brian doesn't. And so Darrow is smart enough. You know, there's an old, you're a lawyer, there's an old line about that we learn in law school when you're taking trial practice is never ask a witness any question mm-hmm where the answer could hurt you.
Yeah.
And so Brian, Darrow, and he hasn't had a chance to prepare or shepherd the witness. He doesn't know what he's going to say, but he is smart enough to never ask about evolution, never ask about majority rule, never ask about the wisdom of the statute. No, ask, as he himself put it later in his autobiography, ask the village atheist questions, the questions that there's no good answer to. Ask him the questions, was the world created in 6 days? How'd you have light before the day that the sun was created? Where did Cain get his wife? Cain was the son of Adam and Eve, and they only had another boy, Abel. And so where did he get his wife? Did Joshua lengthen the day by making the sun stand still, which doesn't work in a Copernican astronomy? It works in a Ptolemaic astronomy, but not in a modern Copernican astronomy. Did all these animals fit in the ark? I mean, questions like that, they've been asked for 2,000 years. There's no good answer to them. And I mean, you either acknowledge them as miracles, or you rationalize them. But if you rationalize them, then your immediate answer is, well, if you can rationalize that, why can't we rationalize that God created humans by a process of theistic evolution, which is what they were arguing? Their witnesses were all basically supporting an idea of theistic evolution, that man, the humans descended from a lower order of animal in a evolutionary process that could be guided by God. There's nothing in science that objects to a viewpoint. But the statute does. And so Brian was just caught answering these questions. And what he does is he sometimes accepts them and sometimes he rationalizes. Like he said, well, Joshua, of course, didn't lengthen the day by making the sun stand still. He made it by making the earth stand still, and therefore the sun appeared to stand still. And, you know, he says, no, the world wasn't created in six literal days, each of those days. And this was in line with conservative scholarship at the time. Each of those days of creation symbolized the geological ages that had been accepted since Cuvier and Hitchcock and the other geologists, Christian geologists of the first half of the 1800s, and was in all the evangelical literature of the period, the fundamentals and stuff like that, and the Scofield Reference Bible. So it, so, and then they say,
so
well,
Darrow really gets the better of this exchange, like really, you know, quote unquote wins.
He does. He sounds mean. He sounds demeaning to a senior statesman. To the educated Northerners and educated people throughout America, the people inclined to his side already, he makes Bryan look foolish. And that was played in a major way. New York Times had a funny lead editorial in the next day's New York Times saying, we always knew Bryan had a empty brain case, but we didn't know, we know he was deficient as a thinker or something like that, but we didn't know how empty it was until he was forced to take inventory. And so, yeah, but on the other hand, the people inclined toward his side viewed it as, viewed, literally presented Darrow as the devil and said, well, who wouldn't look like a fool if you were subject to cross-examination? And by the way, the judge allowed Darrow the privilege of cross-examining, even though it was his own witness, which allows you to lead leading questions and all sorts of other tactics. Who wouldn't look like a fool if you were subjected to Darrow's questioning? And they tended to sympathize with Bryan, and they tended to view this as more than they ever had in the past. Because if you go back in the 1800s, evangelical Christianity was a respected, I mean, of course, they've been part of the abolitionist movement. They've been key to that. They'd been critics of labor exploitation. You had people like Beecher and others. And now they viewed like we're being rejected. It fed into the narrative of America become secularized and hostile to religious voices. And they viewed Darrow was widely presented as persecuting an old man, persecuting Bryan and ridiculing him. And so there was a defensiveness. Notice one of the immediate reactions to the Scopes trial is raising funds to create a fundamentalist college in Dayton, Tennessee, in his honor, still there, Bryan College. And it gives support to schools like Wheaton College in Illinois. It's saying we need to create a counterculture because we're no longer welcome in the major culture. So it does help drive what become the culture wars.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're really, like, you're describing sort of entrenchment. You know, one of the things we often learn from debates is that people become further entrenched in their and that sounds like what is happening here. But, you know, to the bigger point, like, Darrow and the ACLU and Scopes, even if Darrow did, you know, quote unquote, win that exchange, they lost. You know, you write about the jury being out for 9 minutes. Seems like most of that might have been battling the crowds. Didn't even get a chance to sit down. They just huddled for a moment.
They never left the room.
Never left the room. And in liberal and maybe the media circles, you know, the conventional wisdom seems to have been that while the trial was lost, the moral battle was won, and anti-evolution sort of like died of embarrassment for decades. But you've got a different take, and you just started getting into it. So can you elaborate on that legacy of this today?
Well, if you look back, both sides claim victory. Bryan, he died a week
Shocking.
Later, but Bryan claimed victory at the spot, said, we won. And as a reaction, many other cities and other states adopted similar statutes because they had won, technically. But the prosecution, the defense also claimed victory on the spot and said, we've ridiculed a bad law. They had said from the beginning, this was a publicity to try to educate the people not to adopt such laws. And you can see they win. Suddenly, places where there had been a sincere effort to pass these laws, like Minnesota, it ended. So both sides claim victory. But if you look at the newspapers, if you look at the editorials from neutral sources, and I looked at hundreds of them because every newspaper wrote an editorial after it was over of who, and the issue was who won and who lost. And basically, they all said both sides, neither side lost, neither side won. They just elevated this issue. They made it a, they transformed sort of a secondary issue, evolutionary teaching, into a mainline issue. You've entrenched both sides. Words matter. People hear words. And here you had two really articulate spokesmen presenting their viewpoint. And you rallied their, maybe you didn't convince anybody on the other side. Maybe you convinced a few of the new, in-between people. But you entrenched both sides. And you made both sides thought they were the victim. And people love to be victims. Victim is a powerful thing.
Yeah.
And the fundamentalist, Brian would call himself a fundamentalist, evangelicals, whatever term you want to use, viewed they were a victim, but also evolutionists thought they were a victim. And you can play on that victimhood, and that has grown. And anybody who, now, the sort of the secular side, whatever you want to call it, the modernist side, the modern Catholic or Protestant side, whatever you want to call that, they had their story repeated in Inherit the Wind, or in the second best-selling book of the 1930s, Only Yesterday, or the textbooks by Lichtenberg or Hofstadler, Anti-Intellectuals, American History, a major book by Hofstadler. These all presented that side, and they would use... And the Scopes trial became a sort of a focal point. So in secular culture, if you want to call it that, among progressive Christians, a whole variety of people, the Scopes trial became that pivot point. So in books like every basic, normal, popular textbook, whether, you know, used in college or high school, the ones by people like Lichtenberg or Morgan or Hofstadter, the great historians of the 1950s and 60s, those sort of liberal icons, they would present the 20s as a pivot point between just the ones you mentioned, pivot point between modernity and an earlier populist era, between the rural and urban, between industrialization and agriculture, between the old form of government and the New Deal. And the 20s was a pivot point, and the Scopes trial became, in all their books, their textbooks, sort of the pivot point within the 20s, where you could show, you know, the rise of the Klan before and the so-called decline afterwards, the rise of religion before, the decline of religion before, the rise of rural power, the dominance of rural and populism, the new world of expertise, of the New Deal, of science, of modernity, of urbanity, of industrialization. And the Scopes trial just plays a nice big pivot point, and that kept it big. Inherit the Wind sort of underscores that viewpoint. But if you look at the other culture, you look at the culture of conservative Christianity, you can listen to the Scopes songs that were written in country music. There was a whole genre of Scopes songs. There were articles and accounts. There were, I mean, Brian is a hero. Brian dies a week after. He is lionized. A slow-moving train carries his body for a state funeral at Arlington National Cemetery. Here, the anti-militarist Brian buried in Arlington National Cemetery under a grave. You can still visit it. It's like the stump of a tree for a stump speech. Hundreds of thousands of people line the train tracks. For every stop, thousands of people would go by his body. State funeral. All the pallbearers were sitting United States senators who carried his body.
Wow.
He was a hero to these people. And he was a victim because he died a week later. You know, he was a adult diabetic who didn't take care of his blood sugar. He was overweight, and it was a very stressful trial. I don't think it was necessarily the cross-examination, but it was hot as blazes in Dayton, Tennessee. And he was suffering ridicule from H.L. Mencken and from others. One of them commented that, made the comment that about his death is that, God was so mad at things that he threw down a lightning bolt to kill Clarence Darrow, and he missed, and he hit Brian instead. Wow. And that sort of ridicule, which plays at many levels. And so out comes the move to Bill Bryan College. Out comes, you know, ultimately the Christian college movement is beefed up. Later, a more conservative version of anti-evolution comes out with creation science, where you actually are trying, beginning in the 50s, where you are trying to give scientific support for a young earth creationism, a biblical view of creationism, which didn't even exist in Bryan's day. So up comes the creation science movement, equal time movements, and then intelligent design movement. And one of the pushes for homeschooling and for Christian high schools, sure, a lot of the Christian Academy movement starts with the desegregation in the South, but one of the issues they push rather than that is that, you know, we won't teach evolution becomes an issue, and we'll have school prayer after the Supreme Court bans school prayer in the early 60s, that becomes a co-equal issue with it. And so up these issues continue. And so you can see from how they continue to thrive and live that, well, simply put, the Scopes trial did not end anti-evolutionism in America.
No, I mean, it doesn't seem like it resolved that. I mean, it really seems like it elevated the culture war more than anything else. Professor Larson, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us to explain this. It's fascinating. The book is Summer for the Gods. It's a Pulitzer winner. Everybody go get it, read it. Now is the time. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all your work. Your two books, I think they're two that I know of. We thank you for them.
Thank you. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.